The headline, Saudi Arabia launches fresh air raids on Yemen, once again targeting the international airport in the capital Sana'a. The Afghan government and the Taliban say that they've reached a preliminary deal to press on with peace talks. And the European Union criticizes Britain's rapid approval of a coronavirus vaccine developed by an American drug maker and its German partner. Thanks for joining us. Saudi Arabia has carried out fresh air raids on Yemen, once again targeting the international airport in the capital Sana'a. According to the Yemeni media, Saudi warplanes pounded the airport, including its waiting lounge, twice. No immediate reports of possible casualties, but the building reportedly sustained heavy damage. Saudi Arabia, along with some of its regional allies and backed by the U.S., launched a devastating military campaign against Yemen in early 2015. Tens of thousands of people, most of them civilians, have been killed in Saudi aerial bombardments and tank shelling almost on a daily basis. And staying with Yemen, it says 85% of its population lives below the poverty line due to years-long Saudi war and blockade. Yemen says the war has pushed unemployment there to 65%. It says the Saudi war has also caused food insecurity for 20 million Yemenis, with nearly half of them in a dire situation. The Yemeni government says that restrictions caused by the Saudi blockade have denied thousands of patients access to treatment abroad. Those restrictions have also caused shortages of vital medicines and medical supplies. Saudi Arabia began its war in Yemen in March 2015 and imposed an all-out blockade on the country. Conflict has so far killed nearly 17,000 Yemenis, mostly civilians. Political commentator Hossein Abulkheiti believes the international community has adopted a biased approach towards Yemen amid the ongoing devastating Saudi-led war in the country.
The United Nations actually has not said anything. Who's blocking this food from preventing the food and this help to come to Yemen is actually Saudi coalition blockade in Yemen. They are not allowing food ship or either fuel ship to reach Yemen. And in this report, we have seen that Saudi has focused their main airstrike on airport and port, and as well on the education in Yemen and health system. They have destroyed more than 400 either hospital or health clinic. 400 schools has been completely destroyed. More than 3,000 either education center or an institute has been either completely destroyed or partially destroyed or taken out of service. This actually show you the bias from the international community, because they are not pinpointing who is behind this.
The Afghan government and the Taliban say that they have reached a preliminary deal to press on with peace talks. It's the first written agreement between Kabul and the militant group in nearly two decades. It lays out 21 guiding principles for dialogue and will allow negotiators to move forward on substantive issues, including talks on a ceasefire. Teams representing the Afghan government and the Taliban launched talks in the Qatari capital Doha in September. The negotiations stalled over the basic framework of talks and an agenda still undecided. Last month, the two sides came closer to inking a document, but the Taliban backed off because of the disagreement with the wording, among other things. Amin Alami is a correspondent joining us from Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. So tell us what kind of agreement they have reached and what it means in terms of getting closer to an overall agreement.
Of course, the recent declaration of agreements between the Taliban negotiating team and the Afghan government negotiating team and the Qatari capital, Doha, has created optimism here in Afghanistan, not only among Afghan government officials, but also among political leaders and even public here, because the voice of insecurity and bloodshed in Afghanistan, particularly after the officially opening of the intra-Afghan talks in the Qatari capital, Doha, months ago, created pessimism regarding to bringing peace and stability in this country. In the meantime, the sides of negotiations have their own demands as well. For instance, there are many concerns that have been highlighted so far by not only the Afghan government, but also by many rights bodies, mainly Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission here in Afghanistan. The main causes behind such concerns are considered as the main demands of the people of Afghanistan as well. And this is because the Afghan government believes that there are many, many achievements that have been, that must be protected under any negotiation or under any agreement between the Afghan, between both negotiating teams in Qatar. Issues such as freedom of speech and backing the central government and respecting Afghanistan's constitution are among such demands or concerns that are that have been highlighted by the Afghan government so far. In the meantime, some political analysts believe that given the Afghan High Reconciliation Council is the main body and the main responsible body to directly and effectively manage the peace talks and peace, the issue of peace process in Afghanistan. Abdullah Abdullah, the head of this body, is expected to further work on this issue in order to create more agreements between the Afghan government and the Taliban negotiating team to bring a peace, to bring a final agreement regarding to reaching a peace deal in Afghanistan. But there are also many other important points that cannot be denied regarding to Afghanistan's peace story. One of them is the role of other players in the peace talks of Afghanistan. For instance, the Afghan government has repeatedly said that Afghanistan respects the wants and the demands of other players under the Afghan constitution and under the national interests of Afghanistan. So far, many other players, including mainly Afghanistan's neighboring countries, especially Pakistan, Iran, and India, have so far showed several green lights to officials here in the Afghan capital, Kabul, regarding to boosting relations and boosting cooperation regarding to bringing peace and stability in this country.
Thank you very much for that. Amin Alami, correspondent there from Kabul. Moving on, Iran says its intelligence ministry has identified individuals linked to the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Government spokesman Ali Dabi said an investigation into the murder is underway. He added that Iran will decide a response once the probe is finalized. Fakhrizadeh, who headed the Iranian Defense Ministry's Organization of Defensive Innovation and Research, was assassinated by suspected Israeli-Thai terrorists near the capital Tehran on Friday. The killing has drawn a slew of condemnations from senior officials from across the world. The European Union has criticized Britain's accelerated approval of a COVID-19 vaccine produced by an American drug maker and its German partner. The criticism came from the European Medicines Agency, which is in charge of approving coronavirus vaccines for the 27-member bloc. The agency said its own procedure is more thorough and based on evidence and checks than the fast-track approach adopted by London. A prominent EU lawmaker also called Britain's approval of the vaccine hasty and problematic, recommending bloc members not to follow suit. Meanwhile, UK Health Secretary Matt Hancock has attributed the early approval of the vaccine to his country's break from Brussels, saying that the EU is slow in its approach. Britain is the first Western country to endorse the vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. Said Purizo says Britain are concerned about the safety of a COVID-19 vaccine that the government has approved.
There are concerns on the safety of the vaccine that the government has talked about, the BioNTech-Pfizer vaccine. People in the medical world are concerned about the speed at which this vaccine was developed, a process that usually takes 10 years, but these two companies, this joint venture, has come up with the vaccine in only 10 months, going through the steps that, as I say, normally takes 10 years. So there isn't enough transparency over those steps and how the different trial periods were undergone. So people are, you know, really worried whether or not there will be risks or adverse effects once this vaccine is rolled out and people start taking those jabs. And there is an example of that to confirm some of those doubts and concerns. In 2001, when a British company developed a swine flu vaccine, it ended up giving 1,800 children and young adults, narcolepsy.
The U.S. has recorded more than 2,500 coronavirus deaths in 24 hours. It's the highest daily death toll since late April. The figure was reported by Johns Hopkins University on Tuesday. It registered over 180,000 new infections the same day. According to the university, the number of hospitalizations have hit 99,000. That is a record also. The situation is dire in several Midwestern states, including Indiana and South Dakota. Experts fear that a new surge in infections several days after Thanksgiving holiday that saw millions of Americans travel. Total COVID cases in the U.S. are above 13.7 million. Deaths have exceeded 270,000. Both are the highest in the world. Dwight Reed in Washington, D.C. says the coronavirus crisis in the U.S. is largely due to a lack of a proper state response to the pandemic.
Well, of course, we're seeing from the get-go really a broad trend of inability and unwillingness to treat the pandemic from the top to the bottom, from the federal government to the state government to the local level. And of course, this larger trend of refusing to go along with the Thanksgiving guidelines in many cases, that's contributing to it. But of course, we have to understand that from the get-go, there has been no real state response, no real accountability or responsibility on that end, and it's all been on the individual.
It was a busy day in Iran's parliament. Lawmakers reeling from the assassination of the country's top nuclear scientist passed a draft bill to counter this targeted killing. This was the first retaliatory step to make JCPOA signatories realize the urgency of the matter. The lawmakers said the pressure now needs to be applied on Israel for its role in the crime, along with its accomplices.
Death to America and Israel, were the Iranian lawmakers' chants in condemnation of the assassination of Iran's top nuclear scientist. The day started with the passing of a draft bill at Iran's parliament. This was the first retaliation by Iran after the assassination of the Iranian scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. The provisions that were passed, which still need to be approved before turning into law, were the backbone of the JCPOA, hard-fought in negotiations between Iran and the world powers. Some of the provisions that were passed by Iran's parliament include the enrichment of uranium up to 20% level and the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran to launch a plant to produce metal uranium in Esfahan. It would also revive heavy water reactor within 2 to 4 months. The number of centrifuges would also increase. This would be a clear blow to the IAEA and the world powers, since Iran has been compliant in working with the organization. But Parliament has also sent a 3-month deadline for it to stop applying additional protocols of the IAEA, a draft bill that will also require the Iranian government to stop any IAEA inspections beyond additional protocol. All of this should sound familiar, since they were part of the JCPOA. But now, Iran is arguing that enough is enough. The JCPOA wasn't even fully operational, and that it had become a tool for the European signatories to apply pressure on Iran, whilst allowing the EU to remain on the fence when it came to treading between Iran and the United States.
Well, ever since the United States, at the behest of Donald Trump, left the JCPOA, and I believe that's about 2.5 years ago, there has been repeated urgings by the European powers that are still in the agreement and the other powers that are still in the agreement beseeching Iran to wait, that they'll do something, they'll take measures to help relieve the problem of the sanctions imposed by the United States. But as far as we can see, very, very little has happened. So it comes to a point where now we have another assassination of a leading scientist. leading official. We have word from Washington that the Trump administration and Trump himself is thinking, can we have a military strike on Iran? So, you know, given these circumstances, I don't think that the Iranian government had any choice but to take further action.
So where do things stand right now? Pure and simple, Iran is demanding for the lifting of sanctions. The bill that was proposed actually falls under that title, the Bill of Strategic Action Plan to Nullify Sanctions and Protect the Iranian Nation's Right. Now, Iran is pressuring the Europeans to do this, and in turn, the Europeans need to have the U.S. on board. Now, once again, it needs to be said that these Iranian provisions are just the beginning of Iran's retaliation for the heinous Israeli act, which most probably got the consent or active participation of the U.S. Yet in retrospect, it seems like Israel has shot itself in the foot by committing this terrorist act, since the IAEA will be restricted and Iran's nuclear program will advance not towards weaponization, but to continue its civilian nuclear path.
When the U.S. pulled out of the JCPOA under the executive order of Donald Trump, the EU stated that they would remain committed to the accord and continue to respect the terms and conditions of the agreement. Yet, the EU have simply used their rhetoric to sit neatly on the fence and neither respect or disregard issues such as trade, sanctions, and diplomacy with Iran. Yet, with Donald Trump still at the helm at the White House, at least until January, the EU must now start to lobby support from President-elect Joe Biden, which is something that should not be too difficult, as Biden himself has stated that he would like to re-enter the JCPOA once he takes office. Yet for Iran, the options that lie ahead are plentiful when it comes to managing how it will emerge from the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, and how it plays out its diplomatic options in the future, with the expansion of its peaceful civilian nuclear program being just the first step. But what other options then could Iran also choose?
Well, for one thing, Iran could have the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, inspectors leave. The inspectors, ever since the JCPOA was put into place in 2015, they have over and over and over again stated that Iran is meeting all the conditions of the JCPOA. But why would Iran continue to meet the conditions of the JCPOA when other countries are not? And when their adherence to the conditions of the JCPOA, the Iranian government's adherence to them, has not produced anything that is helpful to Iran. And in fact, the situation has gone downhill.
Does this then mean that the Israeli regime has shot itself in the foot by assassinating Fakhrizadeh? Already many nations across the globe have condemned the act, and the consequences now mean that Iran has the upper hand should the future lead to the negotiating table, with Iran able to cite the illegal actions of the Israeli regime as a key reason to undermine the Zionist government of Netanyahu and co. For Iran, as a force for peace in the region and the rest of the world, the time has come for it to progress into the future, having defiantly beaten the maximum pressure policy imposed by Trump, and show the world that it's a cooperative partner. Yet should the need arise, it can still continue on its very capable path without relying on any other nation in the process.
And that is for World News. That's bye-bye for now.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight. The Western Balkans, one of Europe's poorest regions, has for weeks been battling an explosive coronavirus spike, and death toll doubling in the last month alone to reach nearly 10,000. The crisis is exposing gaps in healthcare systems that have long suffered from low funding and a brain drain crisis, with an exodus of promising young doctors and nurses leaving to seek better wages and training abroad. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, data, even before the pandemic began, the Balkans had some of the lowest density rates of doctors in Europe. Hospitals in the region are now facing further shortages of staff, fall victim to the respiratory disease. In Serbia, for example, some 2,000 medical workers have been forced to self-isolate, just as medical wards are seeing a huge inundation of patients filling beds in the capital, Belgrade. In Bosnia-Herzegovina, in North Macedonia and Montenegro are all in Europe's top 10 when it comes to highest per capita death rates on the European continent. We now present you a news report written by staff at Agence France-Presse under the heading Catastrophic, Balkan Healthcare Overwhelmed by Virus Surge. Please stay with us for more of Agence France-Presse's article. Not enough beds and not enough doctors. A skyrocketing coronavirus caseload is pushing hospitals in the Balkans to the cusp of a collapse, in chaotic scenes reminding some medical staff of the region's 1990s wars. After nearly a year of keeping outbreaks more or less under control, the nightmare scenario that the Balkans feared from the start of the pandemic is now starting to unfold. In hard-hit Bosnia-Herzegovina, one doctor described the distress of having to juggle the care of multiple patients whose lives were hanging by a thread. The doctor, who wanted to remain anonymous, told Agence France-Presse, "The situation reminds me of the war, and I'm afraid it could get even worse during the winter." The doctor adding, "We can do the work of three people, but not the work of five." The West Balkans, one of Europe's poorest regions, has for weeks been battling an explosive coronavirus spike, its death toll doubling in the last month alone to reach nearly 10,000. The crisis is exposing gaps in healthcare systems that have long suffered from low funding and a brain drain crisis, with an exodus of promising young doctors and nurses leaving to seek better wages and training abroad. According to the World Health Organization, WHO, data, even before the coronavirus pandemic began, the Balkans had some of the lowest density rates for doctors in Europe. Hospitals in the Balkans region are now facing further shortages as staff fall victim to the respiratory disease. In Serbia, for example, some 2,000 medical workers have been forced to self-isolate, just as medical wards are seeing a huge inundation of patients filling beds in the capital, Belgrade. Rade Panic, the president of the Serbian Doctors' Union, told regional television channel N1 recently, "I never had such an experience in my professional career." The anesthetist, who works in the red zone of a hospital treating the most serious COVID-19 cases, added, "I didn't have room for patients that were medically considered young. I didn't have anywhere to transport them." Bosnia-Herzegovina, North Macedonia and Montenegro are all in Europe's top 10 when it comes to highest per capita death rates on the European continent. Yet governments in the region have been reluctant to return to the drastic lockdowns imposed at the start of the pandemic, instead opting for lighter restrictions such as early closure of restaurants. While Serbia is racing to build two brand new hospitals, Kosovo is considering adapting old hotels into makeshift hospital wards, including the Grand Hotel in downtown Pristina. Overflowing clinics in Pristina mean that some patients, such as 33-year-old Veprim Morina, are being turned away. The fitness instructor told Agence France-Presse, "The doctor told me to take my medication at home since the hospitals are all full." Veprim Morina managed to hire a nurse to provide treatment at home, an option those who can afford it are opting for when possible. He said getting a hospital bed now requires having connections. He added, "You have to be very lucky to find a place in a hospital." In neighboring North Macedonia, the government is marshalling private clinics and their staff to treat COVID-19 patients after public hospitals hit full capacity. North Macedonia's Health Minister Venko Filipce said, "We have been providing new beds, but it is harder and harder." Outside clinics in the capital Skopje, relatives of patients bring food and sometimes even medicine to their loved ones. One man seeking information on his sick relative said, "Catastrophic, unorganized, no one answers the phone for hours," adding, "The medical staff are fighting, giving their best, but they simply cannot do everything." Croatia's doctors have also warned of staff and equipment shortages in Croatia's hospitals. They say more than 2,500 patients are currently hospitalized, and 3,000 would push the healthcare system to the edge of collapse. Experts say politicians have struggled to strike a balance between controlling the virus and protecting fragile economies. Croatian economist Ljubo Jurčić said, "We are too poor that all lockdown measures be repeated twice." In Bosnia-Herzegovina, shops, restaurants and gymnasiums all remain open, while Serbia recently cut hours for businesses but has stopped short of an all-out closure. While progress on vaccines is helping doctors hope, they fear the chaos that would unfold in the meantime. Jasmina Smajic, a doctor in the Bosnian city of Tuzla, said, "I don't understand why the authorities don't put in place more restrictive measures." She added, "Something must be done about this if we want to prevent a catastrophic consequences." Meanwhile, a World Health Organization WHO special COVID-19 envoy has predicted a third wave of the pandemic in Europe in early 2021. If European governments repeat what he said was a failure to do what was needed to prevent the second wave of infections. The World Health Organization's David Nabarro said in an interview with Swiss newspaper, "They missed building up the necessary infrastructure during the summer months after they brought the first wave under control." David Nabarro, a British citizen who campaigned unsuccessfully to become the director of the World Health Organization in 2017, said, "Now we have the second wave of coronavirus. If they don't build the necessary infrastructure, we'll have a third wave early next year." Europe briefly enjoyed sinking infection rates that are now surging again. Germany and France on Saturday saw cases rise by about 40,000 combined. Switzerland and Austria have thousands of cases daily, whilst Turkey reported a record 6,000 new infections. David Nabarro singled out Switzerland's move to allow skiing with wearing face masks required in gondolas, as other alpine nations like Austria have shuttered ski resorts. David Nabarro said Switzerland could reach a very high level of sickness and death. Nabarro was quoted by the newspaper Solothurner Zeitung as saying, "Once the infection rates sink, and they will sink, then we can be as free as we want," he added. "But right now, should ski resorts be open? Under what conditions?" David Nabarro lauded the response of Asian countries like China and South Korea, where infections are now relatively low. "People are fully engaged. They take on behaviors that make it difficult for the virus to transmit. They keep their distance, they wear face masks, they isolate when they're sick, they wash their hands and surfaces. They protect the most endangered groups." David Nabarro also said Asia did not relax restrictions permanently and prematurely. He said, "You must wait until case numbers are low and stay low." He added, "Europe's reaction was incomplete."
Inside Israel. Between 80,000 to 85,000 Israeli businesses are estimated to go out of business this year. That's an 85% rise since last year. Israeli businesses are desperate just to keep open and pay their liabilities, let alone earn an income.
People just want to fight for the right to provide, for the right to give the future for the children. What we are talking about, this is what they want, these small businesses. They don't have power to talk with the government, they don't have power to do nothing. Just they want to fight for the right of them.
Now, Israeli small business owners are despaired of the regime and are taking matters into their own hands. They are calling for civil disobedience against the regime in the form of defying lockdown measures. They are rebelling against the regime's lockdown as they fear a collapse of their business. Israel just got out of a second coronavirus lockdown in 2020. Many businesses were forced to shut down without compensation, leaving them exposed to financial risks. Many of them succumbed to those risks and have already closed. According to a survey published by U.S.-based business analytics firm Dun & Bradstreet, in the first half of the year, 37,600 businesses in Israel closed, including 1,500 cafes and restaurants and around 450 clothing and shoe stores. The number of closures in the first half of 2020 represents a 70% jump compared to the number of closures in 2019. The restaurant, construction, and transportation industries are among the worst hit, along with fashion stores. Before the coronavirus crisis, Israel had more than 14,000 restaurants, but after the first lockdown, that number fell below 12,000. Business owners say that this lockdown is catastrophic, as Israel went into the first lockdown not knowing what its results would be, but now they know they're destructive. The results of people coming in and out of quarantine and lockdowns are payments withheld, projects stalled, cash flow has ceased, and business owners cannot cover paychecks. According to the Israeli Hotel Association, instead of fighting the coronavirus and developing the economy, the regime has developed the virus and fought the economy. The regime's failure of passing a budget for 2020 has added unnecessary uncertainty in the face of the crisis. It is essential that a budget capable of adapting the tools at the disposal of the central bank to current challenges be approved as quickly as possible, according to the Israeli Central Bank. The political crisis between Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his now coalition partner and military minister Benny Gantz has succeeded in yielding no agreement on a budget.
So the atmosphere really among business owners here in Israel is really despair. The business owners have lost a significant amount of their income, of their livelihoods. And unlike people who are employed, business owners actually have a set amount of expenses that are still there, that they still have to pay. In addition to the lack of income that they have. So their crisis, their economic crisis and their economic struggle is actually greater, in addition to the fact that the government doesn't have the same benefits and the same income security for freelance workers and for business owners. Business owners really have, I think, we can't really generalize, but I think the main sentiment towards what the government has been done is that they feel like they have been neglected, like they are not seen, like they are really just on the margin of the priorities of the government and of the authorities. I think everyone can say that, everyone that lost their jobs can say that they are marginalized, that they are not being seen, and that there are no real solutions happening to these people. However, for business owners, that's especially true because most business owners actually lost lost any kind of source of income, and there are almost zero solutions provided by the government and by the new policies that are being enacted for the COVID-19 crisis. The estimate, I think the latest estimate is that one out of five businesses, small businesses, will close due to the pandemic. That's 20% of businesses, and that's 20% of families. That's tens of thousands of families that are not only losing their income, they're also losing their ability to actually secure any kind of income in the future. The uncertainty that this pandemic has presented to us has been unprecedented. We don't have actually any answers. We don't have a certainty of when this will end. We don't know when businesses will actually go back to normal. So that's a much harder crisis, a much harder situation to deal with as a business owner, and because it's not like you have a certain period of time where you don't have a certain income and then you can plan accordingly.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Mark says this regime has killed many businesses, ruined many lives, and has probably caused a massive rise in crime. It has created normalization with others while neglecting normalization at home. Corruption, lies, and deceit are being reported. Where there is smoke, there must be fire. Arlene says synagogues open some schools, but Likud party Israel Katz, referring to Israeli Finance Minister Katz, and Netanyahu did what they could to injure without supporting business owners, shopkeepers, restaurants and cafes, the elderly, the poor, the families. The virus is not over yet. More lockdowns will be the future. Avi says Israeli Finance Minister Katz is a disgrace. The Israeli regime needed to provide financial compensation to the businesses harmed while incentivizing them to preserve public health. Columbus Jewish News says some large retail merchandise chains and small shops in Israel are defying the regime's restrictions and opening their doors in protest against the regime's lockdown, which has been disastrous for the economy and individual business owners.
It looks like they've been very, very badly hit. The real problem is the strong divisions within Israeli society and the extraordinary concern by Netanyahu about international politics and his lack of real attention to a program for resuscitating and attending to the needs of the basic Israeli society.
Israel's decision in September to impose a second nationwide lockdown after a resurgence in coronavirus infections has dealt a hammer blow to the economy and the livelihoods of small business owners. Although the lockdown has ended, restaurants and other public places are not allowed to open. The Israeli regime is gradually allowing some to open and imposing fines for those that challenge the regime. Israeli small business owners are despaired of the regime and are taking matters into their own hands. They are calling for civil disobedience against the regime in the form of defying lockdown measures. They are rebelling against the regime's lockdown as they fear a collapse of their business. One of the organizers of this initiative is known as Lo Yehyeh Beseger, meaning there will be no lockdown in the Israeli Hebrew language. It has called on all small business owners in Israel to open their stores and services to the public. It was founded by a group of small business owners a few months ago and has since gained about 60,000 members over Facebook. It is not clear so far how many businesses have joined the rebellion. However, many stores and other small businesses considered non-essential during the pandemic have continued to operate in secret, behind curtains, or have closed doors, defying regime orders. Unrest is growing among small business owners who demand that their operations be allowed to resume right now. During the latest lockdown in Israel, small businesses were left with two choices: rebel against regime orders or tell their landlords they cannot make rent. Many worry that these restrictions will once more intensify. Business owners believe that the regime doesn't understand that businesses will fail another month like this, and according to Israeli media, it'll all be over. People who have nothing to lose will stay open.
The government actually has done close to nothing to help the people, to help the people and the business owners and employers and employees and everyone that actually has been impacted by this pandemic, economically, socially, and politically. I think the government has really been very, very, very negligent. It's been very disconnected from the needs of the people. It's been very preoccupied with other things. We can see that, you know, many tycoons and millionaires are getting millions of shekels in tax exemptions and tax discounts. where this money could go very easily to education, to health, to welfare, and to business owners. And I think that the fact that this government has failed in really coping with this pandemic and with this crisis really also represents the bigger picture of the system and of the priorities of this government. It's not, the pandemic didn't create the problems. I think it just put the problems on the front where we could actually see them very clearly. It surfaced the problems. It surfaced the years and years of neglecting, of under-budgeting for the different systems that we have. So now we're after the end of a partial end of the second closure. And I think that you could see that smaller businesses are starting to open again. What is sad is that you see that not all of them are opening. If you go just right down here on Mikveh Israel in Tel Aviv, right under our office, you could see that, you know, there are, I think, around 10 shops in the street here, and you could see that two of them actually closed completely. They just didn't make it. And it's very, very sad to see that, to think that this small business belonged to a family, belonged to a mother or to a father, and they just lost their income. They lost their business, and they probably have had that business for years. So some businesses actually did decide to protest and open their businesses despite the closure, despite the instructions of not opening them. That's also because they are, it's a sign of protest. It's a sign of, you know, we're not agreeing with these policies. You cannot choose our health over our livelihood or our livelihood over our health. The government's responsibility is to make sure that we are also healthy, which absolutely justifies the closures and the limitations. However, when you decide to do that, it's the government's responsibility and it should be its priority to make sure that these people do not starve, that the people who are affected by these closures do not actually lose their source of income.
On social media, Israelis talk about fundamental issues. Handicapper Bill says Netanyahu screwed up like his bosom buddy Trump. A2P says even before the coronavirus pandemic, Israel had one of the largest income gaps and poverty rates. A second nationwide virus lockdown has widened those gaps, dealing a new blow to an economy already hit hard by the first round of restrictions. Avi says restaurants also had a responsibility to act responsibly. Too many did not extend outdoor seating, did not have them or staff wear masks, and did not take health or safety measures. Yes, they should have an economic safety net, but they need to take responsibility as well. According to Anne, what is the evidence people were getting sick in restaurants? We have no data. Infuriating.
The Bibi regime has taken over so much of our solidness, our proper life, livelihood here in this country, and we don't feel like we have democracy anymore. We feel that for escaping the law, he's going to be stuck there, and we're going to be stuck forever in a state of some kind of a new monarchy. That's what we feel we have here.
No, we have to separate between the protest, which is growing and which is now lasting for many, many weeks, which is namely directed at Netanyahu and has namely to do with the charges of corruption that he is confronting. This is one episode. Corona and business who cannot open or rebellious is another episode. They not necessarily mix together. The core or the majority of the protests against Netanyahu, the demonstrations which take place almost every evening and for sure every weekend, those protests are mainly political protests against Netanyahu without any connection to the economy or to the pandemic.
Israel is slowly opening up businesses again, but it's been months since they were required to close that it won't have meaningful impact on the economy. Israel's GDP contracted by 28.7% in the second quarter of 2020. That is the sharpest decline in 40 years, according to a report released by the Israeli Central Bureau of Statistics. This while private consumption fell 43.4% in the second fiscal quarter. Israel's debt-to-GDP ratio in 2020 is expected to reach some up to 80%. In September, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, forecast that Israel's economy is expected to contract 6% this year. Israel's economy was showing signs of instability even before the coronavirus pandemic. In fact, there was a political deadlock for about a year that shook the economy, and then the pandemic dealt the final blow. For now, many Israelis say that they've lost hope and trust in the regime and its failure to help them. Here's the news making the press in Israel. The Jerusalem Post. Some 22.7% of Israelis, 938,000 people, were unemployed at the height of the second coronavirus lockdown, according to the Central Bureau of Statistics, Calculus reported. The statistics refer to the first half of October and are based on a poll of the workforce. Ynet News. Israeli Knesset member Betalel Smutrich called for Israel to apply sovereignty over the occupied West Bank before the next U.S. presidential term begins, in the event Democrat nominee Joe Biden wins the 2020 presidential elections. Polls say over 60% of Israelis favor the Republican president over Biden, the former vice president in the Obama administration. I-24 News. Israeli armed forces destroyed the homes of some 80 Palestinians it said were built without permit in the occupied West Bank. The United Nations has called the move the largest demolition operation conducted in over a decade. Bulldozers knocked down livestock enclosures, portable toilets, solar panels, and water containers in an operation that stretched into the night. Globes. Israel's fiscal deficit reached 10.1% of GDP for the 12 months to the end of October, the Ministry of Finance announced. This represents a rise of about 1% from September. The cumulative deficit for January to October 2020 is 122.7 billion new Israeli shekels. In the corresponding period last year, the deficit totaled 37.8 new Israeli shekels. The Ministry of Finance said in response to the deficit figure, the regime's expenditure has risen, tax revenues have fallen, among other things, contributed to the large deficit.
From me and the production team here at Inside Israel, it's goodbye for now.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.